Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I am hopping mad, and I want something in the middle.
Aha! Yep, absolutely.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dan!
Monkey tennis?
Little piss, my foot on his spank.
With a chuckle.
No.
Monkey tennis?
Radical, awesome, mega.
Monkey tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Okay.
Monkey tennis?
Edmunds is a total wazzup of a guy.
Yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
I said, who the hell is that? This is great banter.
Yeah.
Back of the net. Monkey tennis?
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
Hello and welcome back to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast, where we're working our way through Alan's own series from the Oast House Series 2. Today we'll be concentrating on chapters 9 and 10, and I, of course, am Adam Brooks, joined as ever by Tom Dark.
For Christ's sake, pull over, Grant. Get yourself a coffee, you fucking transport minister.
Nick Alder.
Nailed it.
Tom Stab.
Schnapsy always nails it.
And sadly, not Schnapsy. Schnapsy is unavailable on account of being pogoed back into the government. So thanks to everybody who's been in touch with their Partridge opinions, not just about From the Oast House, but in general. As ever, you can get in touch on Instagram at MonkeyTennisPod, Twitter at ThePartridgePod, Facebook.com/ThePartridgePod, ThePartridgePod@gmail.com. And we love a voice note, so why not leave one on the Monkey Tennis hotline 07923 600 017 and feature in a future episode. One thing we like to do before we get into the meat of the episodes is talk about some of the promo that's been going on. Steve Coogan, as ever, has done a medium amount of promo to support this series. And it's my turn to talk a little bit about this week's bit, which was he did an interview with Rolling Stone, which was quite noteworthy because he talked a lot about potential future Alan projects, although we have covered this on a previous episode. So just to skip over that quickly, he said he really wants to do an album of songs as Alan, and I think that's something that we've seen teed up by the introduction of Nathan into this series and the sort of the element of musical stuff that's going on. Also, we know that it's his brother Martin Coogan who's done a lot of the music for this series, and also I presumably wrote some of the songs for Stratagem, so it's a nice family connection there. Get his brother involved. He's also talking about doing a couple of documentaries, talking about going around Britain and finding out what defines being British, taking him around Scotland and Wales for his own Alan Odyssey. So that's something we've heard discussed by the new head of Baby Cow as an idea that they could take to America in future. He also said in the interview, the one card I haven't played is Alan interviewing real people. I mean, he has, but he kind of not in a serious way. An actual talk show. I did a similar thing where I spoke to Elton John, Brian Ferry, Roger Daltrey and Noel Gallagher for Comic Relief, and it worked really well. The thing is, you have to get people who are prepared to let you really take the piss out of them. Not everyone is prepared to do that. Some people just can't take a joke. But there's so much goodwill to Alan that if we did a talk show, I think we'd get some of the most famous people in the world. Not my words, Steve Coogan's words there. So all potential ideas in the pipeline for Alan. But I think possibly the biggest bombshell, bear in mind this interview went out around the time of the first Tory leadership race. He said he thinks Alan Partridge would quite like Liz Truss because he thinks that he'd love to go out with her. And if you think about it, I suppose Liz Truss is a bit of a composite of a lot of Alan's exes. If you take 10% Sonia, 80% Angela, 5% Carol, and perhaps 5% Katrina, as we might come on to talk about, then maybe what you end up with is Liz Truss.
Well, I think isn't Katrina basically 100% Liz Truss?
I was going to say, yeah.
Adam, imagine Liz Truss...
That's true. That's very true. he's done the heavy lifting there for me. So yeah, those are primarily the bombshells. He also mentioned talking about his recent stint on stage with Coldplay that he was pretty sure 30-40% of the Coldplay audience didn't know who he was. He said, which makes it even funnier to me, which I thought had a little hint of Alan's sort of I don't give a fucking shit either way. He's like, I enjoy the fact that people don't know who I am. Do you though? Do you, Steve? So yeah, that's the main content of the Rolling Stone interview. We'll put a link on the socials so you can read the whole thing yourselves. But onto the meat of the episode, starting with episode 9, Brand Ambassador. And today's synopsis comes from Tom Stab.
Yes, episode 9, Brand Ambassador. Still to receive a job offer, Alan wonders if his commercial endorsements are creating a conflict of interest.
And before we jump further into this, can I give an update on our running counters for this series, which is the Grant Shapps count. At the beginning of episode 9, we've had 3 mentions, I believe, and we've also had 3 episodes have had at least some content from inside the Oast House. So that's where our tallies lie at the beginning of this.
Nice. So we start with an introduction to a new character. It's Mike Blank, or Mike Blank. Blank? His surname's Blank.
Mike Blank.
Yeah, Blank.
Blank.
Of Armadillo.
Armadillo Security.
Armadillo Security.
Which I think he does also refer to it as Armadillo Security and Armadillo Blinds in different places, so it's interchangeable, doesn't matter.
He does. There's some language mangling right at the top of the episode where he describes a window as a house's Achilles heel rather than an Achilles heel.
And a promotional YouTube video.
I'm pretty sure he introduces Mike Blank twice as well. He says... we open with I'm with Mike Blank, and then that VO motif comes up and he says I'm with Mike Blank, so it's 2 introductions of Mike Blank within 30 seconds.
That's the first one is from the YouTube video, you see, but obviously it doesn't actually, yeah, it's bad audio yeah. Practice definitely.
So I think Mike sounds like a Gibbons to me, and I know when we say a Gibbons, we never know which one is Rob and which one is Neil, so it's just a Gibbons.
We also get something that we've had in previous Alan interviews. Whenever he's talking to somebody who he sort of wants to be friends with, or primarily has a military background, then he's very deferential to them. And Mike is no exception. So he says he's talking about like the blinds and stuff coming down, the security systems having the same principle as an armadillo. And then Mike says, "You could say that. I mean, obviously you could. That's why he called the company Armadillo." And Alan goes, "Could I? Cheers." Which I thought was really funny that he's sort of so pleased to have Mike's permission to say this very obvious thing.
I enjoyed the list of Mike's kind of credentials because he's been in Iraq, Afghanistan and Kuwait, but it turns out Kuwait was only a holiday, but that's fine because it brings real credibility to the brand. I thought that was a fun little gag.
It's almost like he's suggesting that Mike had his military experience, but felt that it wasn't enough to base the Armadillo brand on that, so he had to just pop over to Kuwait just to make it.
Yeah, two countries wasn't enough, yes.
So yeah, he's talking about filming content. He films some content that could become a YouTube video for the website or be picked up as a number of local press pieces. Also like that he described his relationship with Armadillo as lucratish, not lucrative, lucratish, and that he's obviously just had his contract renewed for a further 3 years, which will go on to cause all sorts of problems later in the episode.
There's a piece where he talks about his brand synergy with that of Armadillo's. I don't know if anyone has any notes on this, but I wanted to query the first one, which was reliable. I'm not sure I would describe Alan Partridge as reliable, and if he wants me to give examples, I am prepared to give them.
Although I would say...
I mean, ask Pete from Dante's Fires, that's all I'd say.
There's probably more credibility behind the claim that he's affordable. Now, that I can believe. We've seen his crash-bang-wallop negotiating tactics, and his example of that is that if you want him for an after-dinner event at the end of your tax year, you can pay it in cash to keep it off the books.
Yeah, so very, very credible there.
I think the two I noted down that I enjoyed the most were, and I think to be fair, his brand synergy is accurate here. Are the blinds beautiful? No, I'm not either. I also really enjoyed the most popular finishes, high gloss white. I'm Caucasian. I thought those were a lot of fun.
And then a couple of other comparisons between him and blinds that literally make barely any sense. That they're both smart, neat, and looking their best when clean. Which, I mean, arguably you could apply that to almost anything.
I think it's worth delving a little bit into also the parallel he draws between them being made in Britain. So the blinds are made in Britain, ditto him. And I thought this next bit was brilliant. If Britain was a woman, so he's basically talking about how much he loves Britain, right? So he's saying, if Britain was a woman, I would happily marry her with everything that entails. You'd have an affair with Italy, but you wouldn't want to be married to it. Britain may not be sexy, but it's not going to go crazy and throw crockery at you just because it caught you looking at videos of other countries on the internet. I really enjoyed that extended metaphor. Very laboured and very funny.
And so we have to assume that that is something that actually happened with Carol, especially given that we know from Alpha Papa that he is a porn enjoyer.
Well, it could have happened with Carol, could have happened with Sonia, could have happened with Angela. I mean, Carol's probably less likely because early 90s.
I think it's Carol because he refers to it being his ex-wife, I think, rather than ex-partner. But I might need to go and fact-check that.
Mm. And I think we'll come to it, but I wouldn't put it past Katrina that she would throw crockery at Alan. But we'll get there.
This is also the point in the episode where I first thought, where is the second part of his Katrina special that we were promised last week? Because this is very much not it. We're talking about blinds so far.
Yeah, and brands he will work with. Gore-Tex, it's a yes. Mm. Solomon,
yes.
It's a yes. Wilkinson Sword.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
He's claiming he turned down Nivea. I'm calling bullshit on that. I'm also saying Nivea are never calling you, pal. It's not happening. Same for Persil. It's not happening. He's saying no to Debenhams. I think you'd say yes.
I have to say, what I enjoyed most about this is the tone at which he gives the no's going through this.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it's no to Nivea, Persil, Debenhams. This really made me laugh because he sounds so annoyed. And let me put it to you, my theory is that in Alan's head, he's reenacting being offered these brand proposals from Lynn. So Lynn's probably, you know, you can imagine that Lynn saying, oh, Alan, Persil want you to do this. No, Debenhams, no. I enjoyed those bits so much, I think we should drop that little clip in because it's very, very good.
Gore-Tex, yes. Solomon, yes. Wilkinson Sword, you betcha. Nivea, no. Persil, no thanks. Debenhams, no.
And also, just to add, didn't Alan do some voiceover work for Tell Me About Debenhams?
Yes.
So he has worked with Debenhams before.
Yep.
And he will work with the most toxic of brands. So
he'll also work with the most dead of brands, because by the time he mentioned this, Debenhams has been in administration for a number of years as well. So he's hardly got his finger on the brand pulse. Interflora, just as another one that he mentioned he would not work with. But what I really enjoyed, I think it came just before this, is him talking about the combination of products and celebrities and the extent to which that makes sense or doesn't make sense. So him and blinds make sense for all the reasons, the nonsense reasons he's given us, like Eamon Holmes and funeral costs make sense. Really enjoyed that. The first of several fairly subtle references to Richard Hammond's diminutive stature. Richard Hammond and hair clay or chunky insoles, it just makes sense.
Yeah, I think there are a few references to Cuban heels and Richard Hammond in the next few episodes, I think. I think the kind of, I guess, what do you call it? The classic Top Gear cast feature quite heavily in this whole series, don't they?
They do.
The Clarkson, Hammond, May trio.
What I love that you're getting across the O's House episodes as well is you're getting a really nice mix of very subtle and very blunt gags at celebrities' expenses. So I think whenever you get Kirsty Allsop come up, it's a fairly it's a straight shot to the brain as far as subtlety goes. Grant Shapps maybe a little bit more subtle. Then you've got Richard Hammond, you know, perhaps more subtle still. And then there's one coming up for James Corden, which I think is so subtle and therefore all the more devastating, but we'll get to it in a second.
Basically, at this point, Alan is then talking about trying to pitch a show and a return to North Norfolk Digital. Did you guys get down the suggested names that he's got for that?
The first was Backchat.
Backchat with Alan Partridge.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the second one, Bullhorn with Alan Partridge. I was slightly disappointed that we didn't get Alan's show being a nominated name there, because that normally happens.
And I think those
it was
are only
absolutely brilliant, I decided.
Yeah.
Those were only the suggestions if he gets his own sort of topical evening chat show, aren't they? He would obviously prefer Drive Time or Breakfast, because he knows that that's the golden slots. There's a great bit about how to handle the Graham, the unfunny station manager, gauging just the right amount of laughter to not encourage him to tell more jokes, but to let him know that you appreciate the joke that he has made.
Yeah, there are some really good lines here. He's the kind of guy that thinks he's funny that isn't. So the response is, ha ha ha, that's a good one, Graham. And nothing beats a quiet chuckle followed by a slight shake of the head coupled with a sigh. So Alan really knows how to deal with somebody like this.
Something we used to get a lot in Partridge and haven't had as much lately is his sort of the fact that accuracy takes precedence over form or style. So he'll ruin a good joke or a good sentence by feeling he has to make it accurate. So when he's kind of giving his spiel here about having a show, he says, "Now I'm listening, and so will the audience be."
Yeah.
But that was quite nice. Like,
I enjoyed that.
Can't let it go.
I've got a note here as well. I thought this is, I was going to say this, possibly reading too much into it, but that's basically what this whole podcast is about anyway. I thought it was interesting that you've got Graham Wilford and Guy Winch being the kind of North Norfolk Digital execs reference in this series. And the fact that they're both GWs, I thought, is that a very kind of obtuse kind of comment on the interchangeability of kind of like faceless radio execs or something? I don't know. Probably not, but you know, they could have given them very different names, and they've given them names that you could quite easily get confused. So
yeah, they've got fairly sort of generic CEO names as well, haven't they? Yeah. Is it time to talk about
you could put Guy Hands could go in there quite easily, couldn't he?
That's true. Is it time to talk about Ross Kemp's tough guy image?
Absolute bombshell, I'd say, as well. I had no idea about this either. I genuinely assumed he was a tough guy. I had no idea that it could have gone the other way.
Yeah. Could have been part of a dance troupe.
Exactly. According to Partridge, none of it comes naturally. He years ago came to a fork in the road where he could have ended up in a dance troupe. I really like these sort of the devastating undermining of celebrities, but told as if it's, you know, a true story. It reminds me a bit of there's a Twitter account, I forget the name, but we'll be able to put it on socials, where it's sort of true celeb facts, and they're all like hilarious, like undoings of their personas. It's really, really funny.
I mean, is that as in actual facts or just nonsense?
No, nonsense.
Like onion style things, yeah.
Yeah, so the account's fake Showbiz News, at Fake Showbiz News on Twitter. I very much recommend it if you're not already following.
Yeah, that's right.
So, we're back on to talking about the presenters of North Norfolk Digital. Early breakfast presenter is Ken Cheddar, which I thought was great. It sounds like one of the names Bob Mortimer comes up with for cats, doesn't it? I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
And then this is where we get to the sort of slightly subtly devastating James Corden thing, which is he used the word optics, and he says that he loves the word since he heard that James Corden's producer uses it up to 5 times in a minute. And I thought that was sort of subtle and great on a lot of levels. One is that optics is a sort of phrase you only use in the context of damage control. So the fact that James Corden's producer is using it tells you a lot about, you know. Also, I think it's just sheer coincidence that we heard this episode the week of the James Corden Balthazar restaurant banning story coming out as well. But I think it all speaks to the same thing. Optics is also a word you tend to use when you want something to look better than it actually is in reality. And it also suggests us that Team Corden is obsessed with buzzwords if they used it 5 times in a minute. So, damaging in many respects.
I think it's fair to say as well, just kind of in TV production land, the word optics would be used. So, it works on all those levels, 100%.
Tom, as someone who works in telly, have you ever used the word optics?
Yes, I think I probably have. What are the optics on this?
So, Alan gets a call from Lynn. Is this the first call from Lynn of the series? I can't recall if we've had a previous one. I think this might be the maiden voyage of Lynn Benfield.
I think it is.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, she's definitely referenced a lot, but actually phoning him, him taking a call from her, I don't think so. Mm. And I still think it's a real shame we don't get Lynn's voice in this series, because we didn't in series one either, did we? And I just feel that could really, for me, that would really raise the game quite a lot.
It wouldn't really break the illusion either. Like, that is a feasible thing that could have happened and be in a podcast.
Do they basically not want to pay Felicity's wage of £9,500?
I think it's probably that. I worry
you'll probably go from an audible drenching to just a heavy soaking. So they're keen to keep the moisture levels at drenched.
moisture too.
They do like to throw... I mean, the phone calls from Lynn and conversations with Lynn are often devices that sort of relate to how his career is going, aren't they? Like, you know, he gets the news from her. She's his intermediary. So so basically, yeah, the news here is there's no word from North Norfolk Digital, who he's clearly trying to get back in the good books of.
I was just going to say, and I guess actually, of course, the comedic device with not hearing Lynn is the fact you're only hearing one side of the conversation. That does allow them to put extra jokes into it based on you're never 100% sure what he's reacting to. I mean, in this phone call, it's pretty clear what's going on. But yeah, I guess that does give them a bit more leeway.
We've never really discussed, and we probably shouldn't do it now, but he doesn't actually have a manager, does he? Lynn kind of fulfills that role in some way, shape,
well,
he says
in iPartridge, like, I've never had a manager, never needed one. And he does he talks about how, like, you take a £50 note and rip part of it off, and that's basically what having a manager, or throwing it on the flame, and that's basically what a manager is. So yeah, he doesn't need one.
You could have a bit of fun character development if you brought a manager in, perhaps in another series or vehicle, perhaps.
Well, Lynn is definitely the closest. And to your point, Tom, about how not having Felicity Montague on the other end of the phone allows them to do other jokes, that's basically what happens in this instance, where Alan goes on a massive sort of ramble and it's just silence. Yeah, and he's just like, Lynn, and oh, you've gone. She's gone.
Because at this point we find out that Lynn hates Schnapps.
Yeah.
So that's another tick on the Schnapps count as well. And also, I think at this point that means, I think we can safely assume, yeah, basically this episode, the majority of it, if not all of it, is also Alan in the Oast House, I think is a safe assumption. Yeah. So I'm going to put Schnapps on 4, Oast House on 4.
Ticks in both
That's
columns.
That's the update, yeah.
Another thing with Lynn, she does seem to just drop off the phone calls with Alan. And given how deferent she is over the years, do you think there's just come a point over the years that she's determined that she can just hang up when she's bored and she won't get in trouble? And she was probably very scared of doing it up to a point, and now she's like, give a fuck, mate, I'm out of here. I don't want to hear you talk about Schnapps again.
Or you've got Lynn struggling with her technology, basically, and accidentally hanging up or something. It could also be a thing.
That could be it. So, yes, there's no word from North Norfolk Digital, and they have a brief conversation about why that might be. They felt initially the chief suspect could be age. Alan doesn't like this because the jazz show has an 81-year-old presenter who has a collapsed nostril, and they still let him on air.
Danny Franchetti. We've heard of him in the past, haven't we?
The next option was that perhaps Alan was disruptive, which I love. That's a suggestion that's come from Lynn, hasn't it, who has no idea what disruption or anarchy or any of these things are in the real world. He uses Grant Schnapps. The Grant Schnapps mention comes in there that he was advised by Grant Schnapps to always be on the side of management. Effectively, Schnapps is a narc. That's basically what he's saying, isn't it? And also talking obviously about Schnapps knows all about industrial relations, because at the point this was being recorded, you've got to believe that that Grant Schnapps was in the thick of the RMT situation, which is obviously still ongoing while we're recording this. So
God, there is so much of this that has become out of date in such a short period of time. Liz Truss,
mad, isn't it?
Liz Truss, Grant Schnapps, and His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales as well later on.
Would you like a gin and tonic, sir?
Save it.
That's quite good, actually, Tom. That's quite good.
Thank you very much.
His new friend Nathan is potentially helping him do a musical about Isambard Kingdom Brunel, the one man industrial revolution.
A tunnel underneath the Thames. Imagine that, a tunnel.
Okay, here's the thing I really liked about this, right? Alan, just like you just said, calling him a one man industrial revolution, but Alan can only list one achievement. Only the Thames tunnel that he references. Also, on a repeat listen, it occurred to me, I was quite surprised that Alan would choose one of his London projects to focus on. Because, you know, for example, why not the Clifton Suspension Bridge or something like that? Like, for him to actually focus on the Thames Tunnel, I thought was also quite funny.
I mean, reading too much into this, has he taken against the Clifton Suspension Bridge because it reminds him of the Clifton Suspension Quiz?
Let's go with that. I like it.
Okay. He's cooking up an egg scramble. He's banjaxing some eggs the next day. He says morning oysters, which I think is the first time he's ever tried to apply.
I like that a lot. I like
a collective name to the listeners. Yeah.
I'm here for egg scramble as well. I'm keen to go with egg scramble. I've never heard of, is it ruched or banjaxed?
Yeah, so that was going to be my question.
How do you want your eggs banjaxed?
As a non-egg eater, I was going to ask egg eaters of the podcast whether banjaxed eggs were actually a thing.
I don't think they're proper culinary terms, no. Yeah.
Do you ever throw a duck egg in with some hen eggs for a creamy finish as well?
That's no, because that would be unholy.
I love that, yeah. Yeah, so Lynn thinks the union of hen and duck eggs is unholy, but she did only recently come around to mixed race marriage, we found out.
Is there broad agreement again for the egg eaters among us that Alan's technique for making egg scramble is pretty good? Well, butter, pinch of salt, caress them around the pan, and then throw them in the bin. But
yeah, to make sure they end up in the bin. Knob of butter, yes. Low and slow, and you know, encourage them around the pan. Yes. Mm. Pinch of salt, no. Many a chef will say never put salt in with the eggs before they start cooking. It makes the eggs go slightly watery. I would just say no to salt. Only season with salt.
And but Nick, wouldn't you rather heavily season, over season even, with black pepper?
Oh yeah, I still do that.
Just for the listeners to understand the amount of black pepper that Nick likes on his eggs, you won't be able to see any egg underneath the pepper once he's finished with it.
Yeah, genuinely, it's got the resemblance of if you've ever been to an active volcano and you're sort of poking about in cooled lava to see the fluorescent underside.
I've never lived with Nick, but the other two have, and you have mentioned
and I can't recommend it.
Propensity for loads of black pepper and not even tasting any of the food before throwing loads of salt all over it.
Yes, and that's what pissed me off about this the most, the fact that you were heavily over-seasoned before you've even seen what it tastes like.
Yeah, the condiment slinger, they called him.
But recently, when we were down in Bristol, Adam, for your birthday, and the morning after, I witnessed Nick putting black pepper on his eggs, and I was quite frankly stunned.
Were you more or less angry than when people butter both halves of the sandwich?
Less, because I don't like eggs, but so it doesn't really make any difference. But Jesus Christ, man, you carpet bombed it.
Yeah, I basically pepper heavily until they are well and truly banjaxed.
So Alan's finished cooking his eggs and says, oh, smell that, forgetting that he's in exclusively audio medium, not for the first time.
Yeah. I love the smell of eggs.
They've really lent into Alan's love of eggs, Steve and the Gibbons, yeah. Haven't they? They really are onto that.
This is the second time. So earlier on in the series, we had him make a cup of tea before he headed off to Tynham and then just leave it. And this time, he's making his eggs and then he just throws them in the bin. No time for those.
Right, but before we get to him binning the eggs, I didn't really clock this until probably the fourth time I listened to this episode. Those scrambled eggs, that's his second breakfast of the day.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's talking about how he's basically, I mean, essentially, he's come to accept that he's not going to be working for North Norfolk Digital. So he says, I kind of feel fucking okay with that. And obviously, the inclusion of the swear word, I think, indicates he absolutely isn't okay with that. But yeah, he then talks about that he's already had a breakfast. He was on the veranda with a bowl of toasted almonds, paleo cereal, scattered over spelt brown flakes with flax blueberries, fat milk, and a dollop of yogurt. So he's had that. Then he's gone on to make scrambled eggs.
It doesn't matter that the eggs are in the bin because, Alan, you are happy. And I thought, is this the day he's really changed? And then I put four question marks in brackets afterwards.
No chance. But the keys to his happiness actually weren't even the breakfast. It was more the glass of Tropicana and a copy of the Daily Mail. And he thought to himself, this is all anyone needs. None of it matters. But as I've said, he's only decided that because he's realised what he wanted is no longer achievable.
Yeah, this reminds me of something he says in series one of the Oesterhouse, where he says, today I'm choosing to be happy. And this feels very much from the mental health school of just choose to be happy and you will be happy.
I'd love to take a second to talk about Alan's gratitude list that he's put together, things that he's grateful for. And I think this is the point where he's talking about things being free as well. So you've got the smell of grass, smiling, humming, scratching, doing a loud fury Trump.
Or funny.
What's
Trump.
Happened there, Adam, is your handwriting's let you down. It's a funny Trump.
funny Trump. Impressions of people from different countries, staring at beautiful women, and how camp or deep you can make your voice go. And
I thought,
rather than a gratitude list, this is just things he's done this morning, isn't it? It's just stuff that's happened to him today.
Arguably, I mean, I don't know about proper self-help terms, whether this be... Does that even work as a gratitude list? Because he's obviously also talked about the best things in life that are free. So that is a list of things he can do that are free. I don't think this would actually constitute an actual gratitude list, because that isn't... Shouldn't it be a list of things that he's thankful for, something which is a bit more of a overview on the like his life situation, whereas that is literally, like you say, just the list of things he's done that morning.
Yeah, I mean, if you compare to this, he's absolutely nailed the bucket list. You know, he's understood the assignment there, whereas yeah, he's way off here. And yeah, he gets so obsessed with trying to do camp voices that he disturbs Rosa and has to explain.
Yeah, I'm just doing camp freeze.
So I love that, because that the way he says that, does that indicate that it's not the first time that Rosa's
And that's absolutely often the joke with Rosa, isn't it? It's like when she's like, 100%. Oh, you're just what is it? You're just reading from your book again.
That. Yeah. But also, is it in series one? Am I remembering this correctly? Does he not panic Seldom by doing it what he terms his camp voice? Doesn't Seldom start growling or something? He's like, it's just me doing camp voice.
Is it upstairs? Oh, are you being served?
You're being served.
When he's doing that. You're being served. I think he's doing that shtick, and then Seldom kicks off. Just me, Seldy, just me.
He spent 4 hours trying to Photoshop himself, and I love that he says, "Why do we do these things?" To which the answer is clearly, we don't. Alan.
Has anyone got the description of what Alan does to himself on Photoshop?
I don't have it in front of me, no.
No, I don't, but I've got an idea, and I think what we should do is let's play in the audio of how Alan describes what he does to himself via Photoshop now, and I would like to challenge any of the Monkey Tennis listeners to do the same Photoshop job on a picture of Alan and make him look like... It's a thin genie, isn't it?
Yes.
To make him look like a thin genie. So let's play that audio in here, and if you could follow along at home on your Photoshop and and do a version of Alan as described now, that would be great.
As a disclaimer, it doesn't need to take you 4 hours.
The other day I spent 4 hours on Photoshop trying to make my shoulders broader, my jaw squarer, and my beard pointier. And whilst initially pleased with the results, I went too far and I ended up looking like a thin genie.
There we go. So, yes, if any listeners want to take on the Photoshop challenge, please do.
It's time to go swimming with Grant Shapps, I think. Another Shapps mention, isn't it?
Correct you, Adam. They play. Yeah, they don't swim. They play.
They get in the water and they just play. What a beautiful image.
He Grant Shapps even pretends to be a whale at times, which sounds like a lot of fun, to be honest.
I'll be honest. I am absolutely loving the Schnappsy doing in this entire series. Yes. It's a real highlight. It really is. They've absolutely nailed it.
Schnappsy always nails it.
They met at a disco, and in principle, Schnappsy is Godfather to...
disco.
Alan is Godfather. No, sorry, Schnappsy is in principle Godfather to Alan's future children. And I thought, what is the chance of that happening now? How many more kids is Alan going to have now?
Never going to happen. Never going to happen. The disco, do you reckon that is a disco at like a Tory party conference or something like that?
I don't know. I think it might just be... I think it's just more of an effort of the writers to make their friendship sound like that of two 10-year-old boys.
Yeah,
in that they met at a disco, they get in the water and just play.
Yeah.
Oh, and my favourite detail about them going swimming, playing in the swimming pool, I guess, is the fact that later on Grant Shapps swims wits. So they're doing wits, not lengths as well, which also contributes to the, them being 10-year-old kids. Yeah,
which, to be fair, he can do.
Yeah, but also their swim is cut short because Shapps swallows some water and gets really cut up about it. Again, another absolute 10-year-old thing.
I guess, before we get more into the Alan and Schnappsy relationship here, so obviously, he's turned up, he's beeping outside the Yost house, so there's no time for the eggs. Alan chucks him straight in the bin and just says fucking dick under his breath, which I thought was a great little sequence.
So I think it's time for a bit of North Norfolk Digital housekeeping, in that it turns out that North Norfolk Digital are in bed with Home Guard security And Alan's worried that he's shot himself in the foot by aligning himself to Armadillo for a 3-year contract. So yes, he's got to really think that one through.
So can we talk a little bit about this? Basically, it's about 14 and a half minutes into the episode or chapter. You basically have, yeah, you've got Alan is in the car, kind of giving us a bit of a, I guess, a monologue on kind of like the conversations that he's had with Grant when they've gone swimming. And him putting him right about Northrop Digital being in bed with Home Guard Security, so a rival firm to Armadillo. And you've basically got about 2 minutes of Alan talking here before there's a big reveal that Schnapps is in the car with him and he's driving, which I thought was just such a weird gag, but I thought also worked really well because you just the fact is like an audio reveal, because the way he's talking about what's just happened, the way he's talking about Grant Schnapps quite freely, you would never have expected that they're still in the car together. I thought that was great. But I would admit there is a bit of name shenanigans that go on here, which I did not understand what the underlying gag was until I did a bit of research on it. Are you guys all up on this?
I'm presuming this is where he calls Schnapsy Michael.
Yes.
So on the first
couple of listens, I was like, I don't understand what that is.
I had to research it myself.
Okay, right. So it's something that passed us all by, basically.
Yeah, but I think what's worth sort of saying is he references that his real name is Michael.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of the point he's making, which kind of was confusing at first and required some research. But please reveal what you found.
Okay. Well. Essentially, and what they're poking fun at is here is Grant Schnapps is his real name, but I think a few years ago now, he basically was forced to admit that he had a second job as a millionaire web marketer whilst he was an MP, and he used the pseudonym Michael Green whilst pursuing this second job, which all sounds like it was quite a kind of dodgy enterprise. So yeah, his pseudonym for that was Michael Green. So Michael isn't his real name, but obviously I think in the APU they're kind of playing around with that whole thing and that whole referencing. But this is something that looks to me like it was originally reported back in like 2005, so just totally passed me by. But you know, a very kind of subtle, potentially confusing reference if you don't know this, but great work from Coogan and the Gibbons to just kind of really stick one in on Grant Schnapps, basically, because yeah, they're kind of very subtly highlighting some untoward parliamentary behaviour.
Wonderful stuff, well woven in. So we also, I was quite shocked to find that that he had filed for divorce from Carol. I'd always assumed it was the other way around. But then that is tempered by the fact that she actually did leave him 6 months earlier. So I think it was more a case of just tying up some last minute admin than really being the driving force behind the divorce.
And we get the clarity that the idiot who drinks the yellow stuff in tins, he was 15 years Alan's junior at the time as well. I don't know if we've had that age difference spelled out before.
A young narcissistic sports pimp. I enjoyed his withdrawal of the offer to go and see Torvald and Dean from Lynn, and
poor
her,
Lynn.
Her instead having to drive him. And was this him and Katrina, or was this someone else?
No, just a Tinder date.
This is just a woman he met on Tinder date. Another Tinder date.
So not even someone he's in a committed relationship with. Yeah.
Did anybody have down Alan's description of Lynn in this segment?
The natural scowler and mopey.
Yes, yep. Natural scowler with a mopey quality at the best of times. Which is obviously great, because it's like, yeah, but that's at the best of times, because that's every time with you she's moping, Alan. That's what's happened there.
And now we come to the first of an occasional series I like to call genuinely touching moments that Alan spoils by trying to do an American accent.
Yes. I know where you're going with it.
Rosa asks him, where good boy, in reference to Seldom. And he has to say, Rosa, Seldom, he didn't make it. He passed away at a fun fair. He ain't never coming home. And he does this quite a lot, I think. Like, we've talked about this before. Yeah. He can't sort of just voice his real emotions. He has to sort of cadge it with some accent or some sort of role play.
A little detail that I really liked here was that Rosa would be quite strict with Seldom, and that it was because Rosa used to raise oxen. And Alan thinks that Seldom respected that.
Yeah.
Similar size animals.
I don't know if anyone is familiar with The Trip, but there's a scene in The Trip where Rob Brydon and Steve Coogan are doing impressions of Richard Gere. And this accent that Steve or Alan uses here is very reminiscent of the interchange that Rob and Steve have on The Trip. So if you haven't heard it, I'd implore you listen to the first episode, series one of The Trip. With the Richard Gere impersonations.
We find out at this point that Spencer was a competition winner for this time and was able to come along and enjoy a behind-the-scenes trip to the set of this time, but then was forced to leave because it turns out that he wasn't technically with his guardian. It's very much a chorister's genes rule kind of situation here where someone's basically kicked out.
And I wonder who tipped off the BBC about her not being a legal guardian.
Well, exactly. Yeah. But he did give Spencer a pair of Primo slippers from the TV show Pointless, so it wasn't a completely wasted day. But thankfully, he managed to find the owner of Yarmouth Powerboats came to fill in, and now, as a result, Alan gets powerboat access twice a year.
What I love about this as well is that this is absolute 1990s BBC behaviour, isn't it? Presenters getting favours for, you know, the children of wealthy people to do work experience on BBC shows.
Yeah.
It just felt like absolute 90s nepotism that I bet was absolutely rife.
I mean, I did think this little section was, I mean, I didn't think it was particularly funny, and it seemed a bit odd to just suddenly go, I mean, I know it's all about the thematically about kind of breaking bad news, but to kind of go back into the this time world, referencing that a bit. But and obviously the payoff is all about Alan saying, couldn't have known it was going to work out that way, which obviously he did because he got that kid kicked out so we could get the son of the Yarmouth Powerboats owner in to get that placement. But I don't know, I just feel like surely there's a better kind of narrative device they could have inserted in here. I don't know, I didn't think it was great, that bit.
I agree, and I feel like they sort of did it because they felt obliged to reference this time and to kind of weave this into the timeline in that way. But I would say that it ends with a bit that I really enjoyed, where he's talking about his two grandmas, namely right-wing Nana. Right-wing Nana and Granny Grumps, who was also right-wing.
Yeah. I like is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, I like the idea in that situation that you're basically applauding a right-wing woman for not also being grumpy.
Yeah. Say what you like about right-wing Nana, at least she's fun.
Is it time for the British Museum and their cultural rape?
Oh, yeah. This is so good. I mean, yes. I could see the joke coming, but it was still funny.
Yeah. I mean, I think we can just kind of explain that basically there's a kind of lengthy monologue from Alan pleading with the British Museum that they return what is rightfully Norwich's, which is a tavern and shield.
Yeah. Which looks like it is a real item in the collection at British Museum.
Do we know if it's actually of Norwich heritage? I assume it is. I feel like they're generally pretty good with their facts and research.
Yes, I believe it's probably a village in Norfolk.
And obviously the punchline here is that Alan then suggests that having made this plea to the British Museum that people go and check out the Elgin Marbles, which are stunning and make for a fantastic day out.
Yeah.
And obviously the Elgin Marbles are heavily contested by, is it Greece?
It's Greece, and have been since 1812.
See, I don't know, like, you know, compare that little segment to the this time Spencer and Granny Pam thing. I think that's just, I think you've got a bit of writing that just feels a bit lacking, and then you've got something which is such a nailed on, in and out, set up, punchline. I just think it's really interesting having those two sections pretty much back to back, and I think one is an example of a minute or so of lacking... one is a minute or so that feels a bit lacking, and one is a minute or so which just is absolutely one of the best moments in the episode, I thought.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And also, I think Elgin Marbles as a reference is so nailed, because not only is it something that's been in dispute for hundreds of years, it's something that, you know, although to some people it's probably a bit of a niche reference, but most people will get it. But also, that contesting has been going on, you know, is still active. So, like, UNESCO came to a decision in 2021 that the UK should return the marbles to Greece, and they haven't been. So it's like, even last year, this battle was still raging on. So I feel like it's the perfect sort of reference point to throw in. So then there's a section where Alan's looking at calls to Twitter, his Twitter followers, to suggest how to break bad news. One of them, a Buddhist, says he just lets the other person get their own way. As a Buddhist, he's not supposed to be asked. and I think this is actually dramatically interrupted by Alan's shouted instructions to Grant Shapps. Grant, what is it?
For Christ's sake, pull over, Grant. Get yourself a coffee. You're a fucking transport minister.
Yep.
And again, the way that happens, that again, it's another reveal, because you've got Alan kind of talking to us in the car. You wouldn't think he's still in the car with Grant Shapps, but turns out he is.
And also, just the obvious point that the transport minister doesn't know how to drive.
Yep.
So it's 3 days later, and now the North Norfolk Digital MD is keen to talk. A direct quote. Alan, keen to seem nonchalant, says, "Chat sounds cool, time TBC." Very cool.
Oh yeah, but well, he hasn't sent that yet, because I think the key point here is that responding straight away would be pathetic. So Alan's going to text him back tomorrow.
That's right.
And he's going to sit on that voicemail for at least a day.
And he doesn't want to be burnt again, since he once accidentally sent a kiss to a builder.
We've all kissed a builder, sent a kiss to a builder by mistake. Now, can I just... this reminded me of a very amusing Twitter thread from a while back now. But I don't know whether you guys are all familiar with this, but... I think we can kind of say friend of the show Fern Brady. She had a bit of a mishap with a builder. This was back in November last year. So there's a bit of a leap from kissing a builder, but you'll see where I'm going with this. So her first tweet in this little series of tweets was, "I've been wearing my boyfriend's hoodie around the house for the last week. I tried to give it back last night. That's not my hoodie," he said. "I realised with horror I've been wearing our builder's hoodie in front of the builder. I had a little sleep in it at one point, came out of my room, said good morning to the builder, wearing his clothes. After realising my mistake after a week, I threw his hoodie into the room he's been working in. He put it in our living room. What does it mean? Am I going out with the builder now? He's pretty old." I just thought, that's just one of those Twitter threads. I remember reading that and it just really stuck with me. So, not quite kissing a builder, but still a bit of builder-based fun.
Send a kiss to a builder, who knows where it might end. In Alan's case, the memory alone seems to have sparked him onto buying a massive Bremont watch.
Do you look up how much those watches cost?
No, but let's just note this is at the end of the episode where he started it saying the best things in life are free, and he's no longer hung up on material concerns.
Yeah, well, he's gone full circle, because they cost around £18,000, £19,000, £20,000.
Sweet.
So you've also got a question. How can Alan afford something like that, considering he isn't actively broadcasting? Where's his money coming from? It could be through Michael Green, perhaps.
Mm. So I think we're coming to the end of this first of the two episodes we're covering this week. But he just has a bit of time to premiere a snippet of one of his songs about Isambard Kingdom Brunel. I say one of his songs, very much controlled by Joy Division, with Isambard Kingdom Brunel songs taped over the top of it. And I thought this is quite a nice joke, really, because obviously... you know, Steve was in 24-Hour Party People, who's very aware of Joy Division, I expect pretty friends of Peter Hook. And so, you know, it would have been a choice of his to put this in. But it's the sort of thing, potentially, that Nathan the Jingle Man could play to Alan and pass off as his own.
And so
Alan thinks, yes, this is a very affecting song that I can use to sing about Isambard Kingdom Brunel.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Don't forget, in the potholing episode, that Alan does actually talk about Joy Division and kind of his... love of Joy Division, which I still think feels quite out of character for what we'd expect from Alan personally, but I don't know. Equally, he does like Gary Numan, so who knows.
And so that ambiguous note brings us to the end of Brand Ambassador and straight on to episode 10, Alpha Male, for which Nick has the synopsis.
Indeed I do. After taking an online course, The Confidence Muscle, with Chip Keeble, Alan musters the machismo, we'll go with that, to make a grand gesture to the woman he loves. So he loves Katrina. He's in love.
Also, we'll get into what he actually does. This is a grand gesture, is it?
Yeah. Yeah, this constitutes a grand gesture, apparently. Katrina!
I think this is the shortest ep of the series. It's under 20 minutes. But I think it packs a lot of punch for its short runtime. So he starts off with, by mangling words, as he often does, Rocky Bilbao rather than Balboa. And yeah, talking about the course he's been taking, The Confidence Muscle by Chip Keeble, which helps men who have perhaps taken a knock as a result of a list of things that include the Me Too movement, cuckolding and boldness, according to Alan.
Early boldness, Adam.
There are five reasons for basically your confidence being gradually pecked away. So yeah, the full list is physical decline, sexual impotency, early boldness, the Me Too movement, and cuckoldry.
I feel like all men will tick
all five.
Probably two of those. Well, yeah, probably. Yeah, it's going to go in two, but we'll say all five. Every man is.
Not seconds after he said Rocky Bilbao, he's also quoting Steven Seagal.
I'm pretty sure it's plural. I think it is plural as well.
There's a smattering of Steven Seagulls. I think that's what it is. I think the list, so yeah, basically in week one of The Confidence Muscle, I think Chip Keeble is giving the men a movie monologue to say out loud in the mirror as part of their shower and shave routine. So I think the list of options, or at least the most popular ones that Alan references, you've got Liam Neeson in Taken, Braveheart, I think some Clint Eastwood's smattering of Steven Seagulls, and Hugh Jackman, which did raise an eyebrow.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
The names that they give to people in the Oast House are generally pretty ludicrous. I would say, however, Chip Keeble is absolutely spot on for some kind of like guru or mentor. I could really picture him.
Or it's the Tom Cruise character in Magnolia. I can't remember what that character's called. Yeah. It's one of those Respect the Cock, that character.
Yeah. I also really like the idea of Wolverine working on a checkout. I just
was going to. Doesn't he describe him as a man with long fingernails?
He does. Yeah. He says Hugh Jackman plays it. When you hear he plays a man with long fingernails, you might think, oh, he works on a checkout. But then you find out it's Wolverine. Presumably,
do you need help packing?
Yeah, presumably the joke there is either or both that people working on a checkout don't do any manual labour, so can afford to have long fingernails, but also just that if you're working on a checkout and you're a man, you're essentially effeminate. That's the joke here, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this chimes with what they've... what's it called? At the Scissored Isle, where he works on the checkout and he says, I unlocked the female part of my brain long dormant when he was on the checkout, as if, like, that is a skill set that is in the female part of the brain and that only women should be working on a checkout.
I mean, there's kind of more of that to come, where he's talking about the uniform of a lot of the people that go in for the Confidence Muscle by Chip Keeble, namely that a lot of them are Americans that wear wife beaters. He says, or as we say in Britain, white vests. Alan says he wouldn't beat a wife even at Scrabble, to which I thought he probably couldn't, could he?
Yeah, definitely. I like that all of Chip's followers basically have the word dog at the end of their names. I say their names, I mean, these are basically nicknames. No one's christened Big Dog, are they? I'd like to think they're not.
Mad so Dog, Chris Dog. Big Dog.
Yep.
Yep.
Big Dog, Mad Dog, Hound Dog, Alpha Dog. I think those are the ones he lists.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the absolute weak squash pun that he's followed by more dogs than 101 Dalmatians and yet another got to try stand-up.
I have got to try stand-up.
I think that's one of his weakest jokes as well, but actually one of his most committed...
got to do stand-ups. So,
yeah, exactly.
Should we talk about him, how he's now standing?
Oh, what, the stance that's now wider than like a doorman or George Osborne?
Yes. So it's worth casting your mind back to, I think, probably 2015 sort of era, when it was all the rage in the Conservative Party to strike a power pose with basically your legs wide apart, almost in a kind of A-shaped formation, which basically resulted in every politician in that party looking like an absolute idiot. And the best thing about this is then in 2016, basically it was the thing they're all doing because they were told by so-called experts that standing like that would basically give them more gravitas, give them more of an air of power. But about a year later, those so-called experts wrote in a blog that there were methodological failings, and it was all nonsense. So that's good, isn't it?
So at no point did anybody look at George Osborne and think, this punk got swag. A sentence that Alan says, and I'm convinced that he only knows the true meaning of 50% of the words in that sentence.
It's also Alan chewing gum. And I think this comes up again before the end of this series, and we've had this in earlier in this series and in series one of The Oast House. Alan chewing gum is his like key signifier for being cool, or being like a bit punk or something like that, which I think is quite funny.
Yeah, I'm chewing more gum than ever.
I do think there's something as well in the in us sort of worrying a bit about Alan falling in with the wrong crowd when he talks about the fact that Chip refers to women as females, wears a MAGA cap, but does get results. And you sort of think Alan is now quite well positioned to be influenced by idiots, and frequently is in this series.
I thought of I quite like though when he makes that point that Alan sort of says that Trump, I think he calls him a dipstick. Mm-hmm. I kind of thought it was a nice touch that could have gone either way, but actually even Alan can see that the man's a bit of a buffoon.
Yeah, and I feel like that's probably quite a deliberate choice, actually, because I think, particularly over the last couple of years, a lot of our kind of dialogue we've had with listeners, particularly off the back of the ending of this time, Series 2, where, you know, it felt like a path could have been laid where Alan could become a Piers Morgan, Dan Wootton type, extremely on the right kind of broadcaster, which would tie in with kind of a Steve Bannon, Donald Trump type world. And, you know, a lot of people saying, you could imagine Alan being like on an APU version of GB News. So I feel like they very deliberately haven't gone down that route because a lot of people have speculated they might do. I think, you know, even with Stratagem, I mean, I haven't seen it, so correct me if I'm wrong, but even with Stratagem, there was a bit of speculation that it could be one a bit of a not exactly right-wing rally. That's a bit too extreme, but it could but it could kind of lent into that kind of world. But I feel like they've deliberately not gone the whole hog in that direction. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah, I think they're trying to sort of confound fan expectation, perhaps a little bit with that. I like the relationship update we get with him and Katrina at this point, that essentially he was about to open his heart to her, but in the end he just bought her some compost, which actually, what we know about Katrina, what we learn about Katrina, I think she'd probably prefer that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So is it fair to say then, is this episode the follow-up to episode 8? I think it's the closest we're going to get to part 2, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And he describes Katrina quite simply as 50 plus and fit.
She is absolutely no nonsense as well, isn't she? I mean, you get many kind of examples of this, but you know, she's very kind of forthright. Probably doesn't take any shit. Knows what she likes, and frankly, is prepared to stand up to Alan. Alan is the Lynn in the Katrina and Alan relationship.
Nice.
I think they're sort of waving that a bit through this as well when he talks about, you know, people's reasons for taking the confidence muscle. One of them is cuckolding. I mean, that is basically, that's what's happening here to Alan, isn't it, really? I mean, one of many examples is he suggests watching Billy Elliot. She says, what's that about? He says, it's about a gay boy in the miners' strike. She mimes hanging herself, and then they watch cats instead.
Oh, I think I'd rather hang myself than watch cats, quite frankly.
Wait, the play or the film? There might be a difference.
20 minutes. I got 20 minutes into the film out of pure curiosity.
Oh, really? It's,
yeah, I just had to see it. But after 20 minutes, it was just unwatchable. So bad. Just so boring as well. It's not. It's just mind-bogglingly boring. But
Who thought that was a good idea?
Tom Hooper and James Corden. The optics are not good.
So I wondered why he wasn't referring to his dates with her as dates, but it becomes apparent. He says, after a few encounters, he's raised the idea of courting her and she's agreed to allow him to try.
that's why
he's not calling them dates, because he hasn't had permission yet.
Do you guys have any of the other examples he gives of kind of... I don't know how to say... How kind of the difficulties he is encountering with trying to get on a level with Katrina.
I think the word is dominance, isn't it? Mm. Like, she's just a very dominant partner. And it would appear a fast eater. He was talking about how she'd be ordering a taxi, and he's like, can I just finish my meal, please?
She doesn't say goodbye at the end of phone calls as well. And he's constantly apologising to her. He drives slower than she does. I think my favourite one, though, is that he wants them both to take their socks off when they're making love. And the query is, though, who is keeping their socks on? It's her, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Surely, if he was doing something that she didn't... Oh, I see what he wants them both to keep them on, and she won't. Yeah. Maybe that's it.
Yeah.
Maybe that's it. There's a very nice throwback to I'm Alan Partridge Series 2, which I expect people got here, about the separation of food. So he says that he wants to sort of make some of the decisions in the relationship. He doesn't like food on top of other food. He wants his peas quartiled in a section of the dinner plate. And I thought, this is very much down the fry up 7/10. I want that to be my choice. Sausage as a breakwater section of I'm Alan Partridge when he's talking about Sonia's full English.
I'm staggered that hadn't even occurred to me, but I think you're saying right. Yeah,
same.
There's a little bit about, I guess, Alan's sort of dating preferences in general here, if he's talking about the Battle of the Bulge, if a woman mentions the Atkins diet, it's probably not much of a future. But if she sees it as the military reference it is, then he sees it lasting. So when Katrina refers to Neville Chamberlain as, and I quote, a fucking pussy, then he's all on board.
I think it's at this point that we get a very kind of recent and topical event with the Will Smith drama that happened kind of earlier this year. I thought it was interesting that they kind of even made reference to this. I don't know what anyone else thought, but it seemed... I just thought it was a surprising thing that they'd kind of put in. Because it's kind of still a little bit raw as a as a kind of a moment in sort of popular culture.
Is it still upsetting you, Nick?
I've still got questions.
You know what? I would agree. I do think this series feels more topical than I think anything Steve and the Gibbons have done. Mm. Because, I mean, there are always references across the whole Partridge output to kind of other figures in popular culture. But those references being quite so timely in this series, I think feels like an evolution, not a revolution. And, you know, as we know, that this was recorded this series was recorded post-stratagem and delivered early September. I think literally the 9th of September had to be delivered to Audible for kind of like checks and sign off and whatever. So it's very interesting that a lot of the kind of political figures they put in for gags, like even their positions have changed possibly multiple times in the last few months. The Will Smith thing, I think that happened like back in March, but it does still feel very, very relevant in terms of it was a massive news story when it happened this year. And I don't think even Oast House Series 1 was anywhere near kind of on the nose with recent events like this has been, whether it's, you've also got things like talking about Putin and stuff like that again, which I think they've really leaned into.
Just to go quickly back to Katrina's reference to Neville Chamberlain being a fucking pussy. Katrina has sort of the whiff of her of a sort of one of those right-wing Daily Mail reading flag shaggers who's just like, oh, it was better in our day and when people had respect for the flag, and like, and also one of those people who'd be like, oh, if I went over there and I was Neville Chamberlain, I would have sorted Hitler out, like I wouldn't have put up for any shit. Just like one of those people who just thinks that they can like go somewhere and sort something out when diplomacy and politics and politicians have had no sort of influence. They just think, oh, send me over there, I'll sort them out, that kind of thing, which obviously is complete nonsense.
What you're saying is, in her Twitter profile, she would definitely have a Union Jack.
Oh, absolutely. Well, we know she loves Help for Heroes, but it would just be like, yeah, it would be Union Jacks.
I think it'd be the George Cross, wouldn't it? I think it'd be the English flag as
yes,
well.
Good. No yeah, messing better. Around. Yeah.
Hashtag All Lives Matter.
I think.
Yeah. Just talking about the Will Smith thing as well, I think what's interesting is that it's not a dig, it's not a sort of reference in a kind of out and out comedic way as well. There's also a sort of subtext, they pretty much say it, that basically he will never be respected in his marriage, which I thought was actually very a very sort of slightly more poignant, slightly closer to the bone reference to Will Smith than they could have made. It could have just been a bit of a joke about slapping someone on stage, but they went there.
And finally, I think the thing that's most crushing of all is that if only Adam had been that little bit more forceful with Eve in the Garden of Eden, we'd have all been having a lovely, sexy time. I'm just disappointed that we've missed out on that.
So what, Adam Brooks? Is it?
If Adam Brooks in the Garden of Eden just hadn't been that little bit more forceful, I'd have been having a sexy time now, Adam.
Just so hungry for Apple. Sorry,
you're not having a sexy time. You're recording a podcast about Alan Partridge.
Yeah, exactly.
On a Friday night.
Time for an unseen Norwich advert here to take you take you away from the glitz and glamour of Norwich, which I think is disputed.
Can I say that this was one of my highlights of the episode? I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah, and it's things like this that I think highlight when the other ones are weak.
Yeah.
And I think we've mentioned a couple of times that there have been a few that have been hit and miss. This is one of the good ones, and it just goes to show how good they can be. Do we think that Alan actually does go dog walking on a golf course then with Seldon? Like, was that something that he would do? Because there's a bit of me that think that, you know, golf courses would appeal to him, but
yeah,
it's a slightly confusing one, isn't it?
I thought that was odd because he refers to tedious golf club members, and you'd think, wouldn't Alan want to be in there with the golf club members? I mean, or maybe that's because he feels ostracized.
Exactly.
By them. Yeah.
I think to build a bit of a story around this, I think he probably has been ostracized, isn't allowed to join, is on a waiting list and never reaches the top. He's had to join the racket club as a bit of a sort of consolation prize. But they can't stop him walking his dog at 6 a.m. before people get to the back nine. That's why he's recommending it here.
They've also got some unlicensed pubs, namely the Bulldog in Sheringham, which is run by Paul and Eileen Jarrow. Again, just something about that name that I quite enjoy. Although, do be warned that twice a month it is the home to dogfighting. So if you can smell dog dirt, just probably keep your distance.
Also, the pub consists of a double garage and gazebo. I thought it was good. Yeah. And also, surely, if it's an unlicensed pub, the last thing they want is to be advertised on an international podcast.
Yes. Yeah, totally. I thought the descriptions of that were brilliant. A lively drinking hole and no mistake. Nothing you say will get you cancelled. Drinks are served with nuts, laughs, and a few home truths. I thought that was brilliant.
Unseen Notch.
So we're moving on. The first thing to me that jumped out, Alan's talking about Women's Hour and talks about loose women, but he described loose women as Women's Hour on white wine, and I just thought there was something about that was just so perfectly encapsulated the difference between those two shows.
Yeah.
It's probably not accurate. I'm certainly not suggesting that the presenters are either drinking, but I just thought that was a very good description of loose women.
But I think that's perfect. You know, it doesn't have to literally be the presenters are drinking white wine. I think
it's the audiences, isn't it?
The way both those shows set out their stall, yeah, I think that's a very succinct piece of writing, which I think absolutely nails it, because Alan always
nailed
it.
Gibbons always nail it.
He goes into another Twitter roundup. He goes to his Twitter followers for answers on more suggestions. I've got to say, I felt
this is the best way to sweep women off their feet. That's right.
So I feel like these next two jokes were quite good, but I also saw both of them coming a mile off. The first one being that inevitably someone's suggestion is going to be about how to physically knock a woman over. That's you know, I feel like that's a joke that most fans would see coming. And then the other one where he's talking about somebody sort of negging females and coming up with a descriptive term for somebody who does that.
Yeah.
And the whole joke about how he doesn't want to say it because it's very similar to a word he's not allowed to say.
Yeah.
So, I mean, It's quite funny, but again, it feels like these two are sort of like the best jokes that fans could write, rather than something that, you know, has sort of come out of left field that would only come from the writers of Partridge.
I also think the best thing about the second one is actually the most stupid part of the joke, which is he sort of sets up and says, "Oh, and Carl from Chesham," and then the message is, "Hello, I'm from Chesham." So again, a bit like the Mike Blank thing. It's the double introduction very quickly.
I mean, I thought the best bit about this really was because he just goes on to talk about negging as a technique that Clarkson uses on Hammond by complimenting May. Yeah.
I thought
that was really fun. And then just going on to the... he then talks about Clarkson's Diddley Squat Farm, the most sarcastic farm in Britain. Don't know what it means, but it's such a corking line, which is a perfect example of what we often call Alan Yes, Coogan No.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. I mean, on that Clarkson bit as well, I really like the fact that not only is he sort of negging Richard Hammond, he does it by complimenting James May, but even the compliments to James May are things like, "Your bootcut jeans are every bit as bootcut as mine." and yes, another reference to Richard Hammond's Cuban heels. Yet another height gag there.
I think perhaps the next thing to run through is Alan's Guide to Dancing, maybe.
Oh, just one quick more thing on Clarkson. He says he once made a joke to Clarkson, who then gestured with his hand. I think we can all guess what the gesture was. And then Alan after that goes, but, he's a good guy. So the fact he's included a but means that we know the gesture was rude.
Does he not explain the gesture is that? Works
does
well
he?
On the podcast.
I don't think so. The sort of waving his hand back and forth as if to say, average.
Yeah, I will. You could wave your hand like that. Or
exactly.
You could wave your hand like that. Again, works well on the podcast.
I was assuming it was a wanker gesture, and I think like the reason that Alan says, "But he's a good guy. He's a good guy," is because he recognizes the potential in Clarkson. To aid his career.
Time to talk about Alan's dancing, and I think we should just preface that this has come in from Leonard in Wiltshire, who essentially says that he'll try and dance his way into women's hearts, and if that doesn't work, he'll just try and dance his way into men's hearts.
And Alan says he does exactly the same thing.
Yeah, but only with women.
Only
with women, despite the fact that he wants to kiss a man on his bucket list, but let's not worry about that now. So yes, have you got the techniques that he employs?
Yeah, I think I can give us this rundown. So don't overthink it. Keep things simple. Shift from side to side, where possible on the beat. Your movement should be fast, not jerky. You want a 90-degree bend at your elbow, a lightly clenched fist, and control your face.
I mean, to be honest, it's a fairly sensible list for once, I would say. That actually makes broad sense in terms of when you're on a dance floor, adhere to those, and
I'm
sure you'll no doubt be dancing in to either women's or men's hearts, but someone's heart will be open to you, I should imagine.
I think the best bit is obviously, when possible, on the beat. It's like, yeah. What else would you be doing?
A recognition that it's not always possible. Surely it is.
There's also a point when he talks about dangerously thumb-slappy bass, which I thought was perhaps a thinly veiled allusion to music to Chameleons and Alan's air bass.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah, definitely.
And then after this, Alan is then asking Rosa for his wheelie case, but we don't know why.
No, not really. Wheelie. That was great. I really
yes, Nick,
that.
We do find out why in about a minute's time.
Yes,
I started to say that sentence, and then my brain sort of started rummaging through the filing system and realised that yes, we do know why.
But before that, it's time for a touching in remembrance section with the Norwich Chamber of Finance Commerce. Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah.
For some of the people we've lost this year, so the list very quickly: Eddie Griggs, Brian Andrews, Johnny Mitchell, Tony Bork. Philip?
No, Tony B. Ward.
Oh, B. Ward. Oh, okay.
That's the handwriting Tony again, isn't it?
That blows my theory out of the water. Carry on.
Philip Shreve, Trev DeFratis, Malik Bulgira, Steve Trammell, Belinda Trammell, the Trammells, Giles Plant, Sydney Wilfer, Bob Head. These are definitely real people as well. Molly St. Edward, Paul Trammell, another Trammell again. They are gone, and then there's a swallow, but forever in our thoughts.
So what do we think happened to the Trammell family that three of them have perished in the last year?
Right. Here's my take on this. I hated this bit. I just think, I would argue, that is a minute of time in a 19-minute ep that just has no significant payoff. That it, to me, this felt like a shame and just a bit of a waste. Like, I think when you compare the standard of writing to Mid-Morning Matters or This Time, which are also dense with layers of joke, I don't think you'd get something like this. Because what's a joke apart from it's an arbitrary list of names? Perhaps you could argue, well, this is a bit like what they did at the BAFTAs. Yes, you've got to think about the three Trammels, what's going on there. But I think for 1 minute out of 19 minutes, this is a real letdown.
I would say I'm 75% with you, 25% prepared to find that there is actually a very clever joke woven through these names that haven't got.
Yeah,
I looked a lot of them up. A number of them are famous actors' names, have been in various films, some of which seem to have worked in the comedy industry. So I don't know if it's like a list of actors from the Gibbons' favourite movies or if there's some other joke that we'll have explained to us by listeners.
If it's like a thing where you have to go and Google 14 names to get the joke, that's not a good bit of writing, I don't think.
I see where you're coming from. I actually do disagree, and I think that there is humour in something as banal as him reading names. I'm keen to revisit some of the names shortly, but I would say I actually did find this really funny. You know, the fact that Alan is reading out these names in some kind of, you know, remembrance, as if that is a thing that happens in a local business community. Yes, it's sad obviously when people die, but this just is not a thing and doesn't happen. It's the names themselves, it's the way that he reads them, and then it's after all of that he fumbles the final line to actually pay tribute to them.
Because he's so choked up.
It's stupid, don't get me wrong, it is stupid, but I thought it was funny. We have heard the name Malik Bulgira, and I'm pretty sure he's in Oast House Series 1, but I didn't have the time to go through all of Oast House Series 1, so I would put this out there if anyone has any builds on some of these names and how they link to the APU. Be gratefully received.
And look, you know what, I guess that is the thing about this. Like, yeah, maybe there is a very obvious gag which we're not getting. We're obviously, and I'm sure if our listeners have listened to all 140 odd episodes of this, you will very well know that we don't always get necessarily what the references are. But I just think if you're literally having to scrabble around and research what the joke is to get it, I'm just not convinced that it's great. And I do get there are a few layers where this can work, so I think, you know, it's good if some of us like it and some of us don't. Like, it can just be the randomness of the names, or it can be that would the Norfolk business community have a in remembrance section like the BAFTAs does. But I just think they've got better than this in them, and when these episodes are so short, that's what really riled me about this. You know, it's kind of similar to, you've got all the list of names at the beginning of episode one of this series, and you know, whether there are more layered gags to be found within what those names are, possibly. I mean, those names felt more comedic than names in episode one. But yeah, I'd be really interested to know what our listeners made of that.
Crack out the really case. I mean, crack out the wheelie case. We're going on holiday.
Are we?
Yes, because Alan's tactic, Chip Keeble's course, has paid off, and all it took was offering to take somebody on an all-expenses-paid trip to Dubai.
Which, again, how is he financing this?
No idea. But I like the idea that he thinks that what's worked here are his sort of confidence tactics, whereas it feels like what's actually worked is that a woman is prepared to go with him to Dubai if he pays for everything.
And as long as you can drink in the hotel.
Yes. Yeah.
That's the clincher.
That's the first question.
Also enjoyed the mini revelation here that Katrina's mum cleans her house twice a week. Whose mum does that?
Yeah, that's mad. I enjoyed that Alan has planned a slap-up dinner with options for Katrina at the end, which I thought were very good. But the fact that she had to choose from four was mad. The fact that he would present them to her, equally mad. And those options are watch a Bond film. I mean, why would you? Watch a Bourne film. Now I'm interested. Play backgammon in fluffy dressing gowns. That actually does sound nice. Although fluffy dressing gowns in Dubai? No way. Or finally, and I do think this is a great term, a bit like Banjak steaks, it's an underwear cuddle.
When he first started
an underwear cuddle in bed.
When he first said 10:30 p.m. activity TBC, I thought surely the only option here is sexual activity. To find that sexual activity forms 25% of the options, and even then
it's on the menu.
And even then basically it's a clothed cuddle. That's absolutely great.
Yeah, I actually would have. I thought this might, the term might be a naked cuddle in bed or something like that. I would have expected that perhaps, but no, the underwear shall remain on. That is a key.
To do a little bit of research to Katrina's point, Club World does constitute business class. Alan says, "Yeah, yeah,
it's not clear.
Near as damn it." I mean, yeah, you could argue maybe not, but it is their equivalent of business class. And he then mangles the word valet.
Yep.
Oh yeah.
I also like that Katrina is, you know, going back to her dominance. She won't just come in for a kiss. They have to negotiate and meet by the island. I just thought that was great that she wouldn't even at that point just come in for a cuddle.
Look how proud he is of coming up with the phrase promises as well. Really, really chuffed with himself.
I also enjoyed, I think, the kind of conclusion of this little scene playing out is Katrina saying she'd better pack an overnight bag, and Alan says, "You better, and don't forget your toiletries." Surely toiletries are one of the key components of packing an overnight bag. That was good.
He says to himself, "Not a bad day." And he necked his drink in one glug. You would assume it was some kind of whiskey, but he's like, "Nothing refreshes like a fizzy drink."
Or a nice cold glass of milk.
Exactly. I thought it's a nice nod back to the glass of milk. It's a nice reveal that after all that, he's celebrating basically with some fizzy pop. And then does a really, really long burp.
And muttered a quiet, "Yeah."
Just before we get to the song for Katrina, I thought it's quite interesting to look at Alan's evolution of women. I think he basically got burned by Carol, and ever since then has pretty much kept himself to sort of safe bets. Sonia could be confused, Angela could be overruled. It's only now that he's going for a strong woman again, which I thought was quite interesting. Arguably, he's gone too strong and needs to dial it back a bit, but... Yeah. I'm sure we'll hear more from Katrina in other Partridge lore down the line as well. And speaking of Katrina, it's time for her song. Again, I think they're slowly building the case for an Alan Partridge album, aren't they, here? And this song is funny, but I would say, as with all comedy albums, it's funny about three or four times, and then it's not funny anymore.
I really like this. I think it's funny. And also, what is good about it is it's very short. My concern about this Alan Partridge album is that there's going to be songs that are 2.5, 3 minutes, maybe longer, that are just going to be really bad. I think this is short, this is punchy, and I really, really enjoy it.
I mean, look, I'll take the kind of opposing line on this. I mean, look, I do think part of the joke of this song is it's deliberately bad. Like, it's very cheesy. The rhyming is overly simplistic.
The music
Wax,
is
tax,
terrible.
Trooper Cooper, Natamata. Yeah, the whole thing's really naff. And I can get that that's obviously a deliberate construct of the joke. But I still just didn't think it was that funny. And yeah, I would definitely say, the more musical interludes we hear at the end of the episodes, the more I am nervous about the next Partridge project, or any Partridge project, being a full musical album. I'm not sure that's something that we need, personally.
I mean, all I would say as a kind of defence of this song is I found it very, very funny. But then again, this is absolutely my level. So this really spoke to me. I thought it was great. I genuinely thought it was funny. And I do think that some of the songs, in all seriousness, haven't been great. So we had the Joy Division example, obviously, in the earlier episode. I didn't find that funny. Whereas the stupidity, the banality and simplicity, for me, made it funny. And I do think it's got a bit of a jovial rhythm to it. So, yeah, it's stupid, but that doesn't mean I can't and didn't find it funny because I did.
I think I can absolutely sit on the fence on this one and say that I found it funny. I thought it was really good in the context of a podcast where most of the podcast is not this, and this is something that's tacked on the end as a bit of a bonus. If this is the meat of the Partridge project, if the whole project is this, to be based on the merits of just this, then I think it will get tired quite quickly.
Yeah,
and I think it's interesting as well. I would definitely agree the Joy Division aping song, the Isambard Kingdom Brunel song, that isn't funny at all. Actually, I hadn't even really thought about that. Like, that gets no chuckles. At least with the Katrina song, yes, it gets a chuckle on maybe the first or second listen. But you're not going to be coming back to this podcast going, "I can't wait to hear that song again for the 20th time." I just don't think it has that kind of longevity to a lot of what we. Well, actually, Nick's grinning. He will be.
Yeah, I will as well. I will as well.
I just love it.
Katrina.
Can we...
She says that all lives matter.
when we do the series wrap-up next week, can we determine, probably by a poll between us, what the best song of this series is? Something exciting to tune in for next week.
I think so. Also, I would say if you don't like musical interludes, you're really going to hate Stratagem when you finally see it. So I think that brings us to the end of this this week's Monkey Tennis. Thanks so much for listening, and a special thanks to everybody who throws us a couple of quid at ko-fi.com/monkeytennis. We really appreciate it when you do. We're going to be back next week for the season finale, or end of the series as we call it in Britain, where we'll be talking about Perfect Days, and I'm sure you can agree, whether it's crisps and wanking, a feast of fools, or yodeling in the Swiss Alps, that no perfect day could be better than listening to the final Monkey Tennis of the series. So from all of us at Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge Fan Podcast, see you next week. Thanks and goodbye.
Have you seen her?
I am hopping mad, and I want something in the middle. Aha!
Yep, absolutely.
Monkey Tennis?
Bring, bring.
There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dan!
Monkey Tennis?
Little pierce my foot on the spike.
With a chuckle, with a chuckle.
No.
Monkey Tennis?
Radical, awesome, mega.
Monkey Tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Okay.
Monkey Tennis?
Edmonds is a total wazzup of a guy.
Yes, 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 and yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
I said, who the hell is that?
This is great banter.
Yeah.
Back of the net.
Monkey Tennis?
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.